Welcome again to Harmonicast, the podcast for harmonica players featuring conversations with great harp players. I'm Bob Kessler, the harpist who created this show, and this week, someone who I was really excited to meet and have been a longtime admirer of, Karen Mantler, who came to Chicago from New York, where she lives. But we'll get to Karen's conversation in a little bit. But first, I want to tell you, I have launched a Kickstarter campaign. I'm calling it Get My Ass to Nashville. Now, here's why I want to get to Nashville. Charlie McCoy, Jelly Roll Johnson, and Buddy Green. They're three of the greatest players of all time, and they're all based in Nashville. Found out really just within days, even hours of each other, that these three guys would be willing to come on to Harmonicast. In the case of Charlie, I don't think he does much touring anymore. Buddy Green, he does tour, but I didn't want to do something where I just have to squeeze him in. Jelly Roll Johnson, I also don't think he tours too much. So really the best way to have these conversations, I've determined, is in person. Yes, occasionally I do Skype, but that's if like they live in Germany, like Steve Baker, or the UK, or Peter Hope Evans, who doesn't really travel too much. So the only way to talk to those guys was to use Skype. But when I can do it in person, I think that's always best. And yeah, there's a lot of people in Chicago I can talk to, and they're wonderful, but we're talking about three legends here: Charlie McCoy, Jelly Roll Johnson, and Buddy Green. So I'm asking for people's contributions, and that'll cover me to head down to Nashville, cover my meals and accommodations and stuff. And I have the budget all laid out on the Kickstarter page. And as you can see, it's nothing too extravagant. I'm just asking for people to help me cover the basics. And then I'll put them out as premium content in early December. So I got a Kickstarter campaign. If you go to my website, bobkesslerharmonica.com. There are links there, and there's more information on that. And if you've contributed so far, you have my deepest gratitude. All right, let's get to this week's conversation. It's Karen Mantler. She does wonderful music. She plays harmonica, but she also sings, plays piano, organ, originally glockenspiel. And her songs are incredibly personal. Wonderful writing, wonderful melodies, great use of harmony, kind of quirky and idiosyncratic, you might say. But I've always found a great deal of enjoyment in her records. She came out with a new one 2 years ago called Business is Bad, and we talk about that. And she was in town because of her mother. Her mother is Carla Bley, the great jazz composer, arranger, and pianist. And so Karen was here when her mom was going to play Chicago Jazz Fest, and that's where I caught up with her, downtown Chicago at WGN Radio Studios. WGN posts this podcast at WGNplus.com, so thanks to them for doing that and for letting us use the studio. So let's get into the conversation. Karen Mantler came by and handed me a stack of CDs that she's on, some from her mother, Carla Bley, and then one of her own that's been very, very hard to find. Karen Mantler's Pet Project Bootleg Special Edition, when was this supposed to come out?
Well, it did come out. It came out on Virgin Classics, and it was 2000? It was my big break. I got, you know, I finally
major
got
label.
Signed by a major label. But what that means is that they paid for the production costs, and then they disappeared, and they didn't promote it. And the guy who gave me the money got fired, and that band really never worked. We played a couple of gigs, and it was too large. It was like 9 people.
And these are a lot of people that you've been playing with for a long time. Eric Mingus, is he Charles Mingus' son?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Michael Evans,
yeah.
And Arturo Farrell, and the late Hiram Bullock. Your mother, Carla Bley, Steve Swallow produced it, so...
Yeah, it was a really good record, but in the end I decided being on a small family-run label works out better than being on a large major label because people actually care about the record.
And when you say family-run, that's like your actual family.
Well, my mother has a record label called Watt, and then she started another subsidiary called Extra Watt for me and Steve Swallow. Because Watt only has her records and my father's records. So it's a family business.
And I really want to know what it was like growing up
in such a musical family as yours? Was music just kind of everywhere all the time? As it says in your bio, you were conceived at the Newport Jazz Festival, so it starts from there? Or
yeah.
What role did music have in your growing up?
Well, both my parents were musicians, so I was always in the recording studio and at the clubs and being brought around on tours, and yeah, it was all music.
Even from like tiny infant age, were you on tour?
Yes, when I was a baby, I was brought on the Jazz Realities tour or whatever. In fact, there's a very famous story that my mother checked me with the coat check girl, who agreed to do it, but then it was somehow somebody saw there was a baby in the coat check room and made a big stink about it, and it was in the papers next day, like, horrible mother checks her child in the coat room. Scandalous.
You turned out all right.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I also went to regular school, and at certain points in my life, they just sort of left me at home or left me with another family of, you know, my friend's family. But when I was 10, she said, well, you know, we can't just carry you around. You've got to learn to be useful, so we'll teach you an instrument. So I started playing glockenspiel in her band.
When you were 10?
So yeah.
It's like mid-70s?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 76. So that's when she had a 10-piece band, and so I played glockenspiel.
The whole set? Band.
Yeah, well, but you know how glockenspiel is. It's like you sit there and count bars, and then you play like two notes at the very end or something. You know.
But it taught you a lot by doing that, how to work.
I learned how to count.
Yeah.
I really learned how to count.
And did your mother ever sit down and give you, you know, proper formal lessons? Was that ever part of it?
Yeah, I learned how to read music before I learned how to read English.
Really?
Yeah, I started right away, like 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And then I learned, after glockenspiel, when I got to be around 12 or 13, I became, when I was a teenager, I started being less submissive and getting into trouble. And at that point, I got fired from the band for a few years. But when I was 17, I had been working with bands of my own, and I had learned how to play organ, and she brought me back into the band, this time as the organ player. So then I was touring for many years with her big band.
You know, the thing that I notice about your stuff, and I think your mother's too, is there's this kind of harmonic sure-footedness that I hear. Is that something that's just in the DNA? Or, I mean, that's not the only thing to listen for, but that's one thing I notice. I mean, did you sit down and have proper lessons and like, well, we're going to learn about chords today?
Well, my mother didn't actually know anything. She was self-taught, and I think that's why she's unique, is that she wasn't really educated. She just heard this music,
yeah.
And she was a little different. She heard things differently, and she just was sheltered enough to enable her to not be changed and learn cliches. And so I was the same. She always impressed on me that it was important to be original. And I fought, you know, well, now we're both more educated. But when I was younger, I would say, you know, I had piano teachers or whatever, and they'd want to teach me the blues, and I'd say, no, I'm not playing the blues. That's a cliche, and why should I play the blues? I'm not from the South, and I'm not black. And, of course, later on I realized that it's helpful to know the history of music and all the standard chord progressions and all that,
yeah.
Which all ties to church music, and my mother, she'd learned through church. You know, her father was a church organist. So was her mother. And so she learned. They had her, you know, working in the church when she was a kid. But later on, Steve Swallow was more involved with both of us living with Carla. They've lived together a long time. And he is very well educated about harmony and chord changes. And we started asking him, well, what is this? See this stack of notes? What is that? And he really taught Carla a lot, and then and me also. And he produced a lot of my records, so we both owe him a lot.
And, I mean, for people who don't know, I think that your mother, Carla Bley, is like one of the most important jazz composers, arrangers in the last 50 years. I mean, her music changed my life, as we were talking about before. I learned to play clarinet because of the tune Jesus Maria that she wrote and the record by Jimmy Giuffre.
Mm-hmm.
Fusion or Thesis, I forget which one.
Wow.
And Steve Swallow plays bass on that one.
Yeah.
And her one-time husband, Paul Bley, is a piano player. So did you know that about her growing up? I mean, that's my opinion. I think I'm not the only one who feels that way about her and her work.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, she's very famous among a certain select few.
Yeah. Criminally not known in the U.S., I think. I mean, she's playing the Chicago Jazz Fest. That's why you're here. And it's like, I don't remember the last time she was ever in Chicago.
No, she was always working in Europe and very popular in Europe. But the States, really nothing. I mean, just here and there. Now that she's turned 80, somehow that has made her,
She got the NEA thing. Right?
Yeah, she got this Jazz Master's Award, and somehow she fits into that box that American commerce needs. You know, she they must have had a quota for 80-year-old women that year or something.
Yeah.
Hate to say. But yeah, for anybody who has listened to a lot of jazz sort of knows, I mean, I would say it's like there's Gil Evans and then Carla, sort of the next one after that, you know, and along the same lines. And she really has always pushed the envelope of music and harmony, and she's never sort of repeated herself. She's always striving to do the next thing.
Yeah, has she made a bad record yet? I don't think that's happened.
Well, I don't think so.
And neither of you. We're not here just to talk about your mother. I mean, you've also come up with your own unique vision, and to me it seems really authentic to who you are. And harmonica is part of that, so that's kind of the reason, too, that I wanted to talk to you. When did harmonica get involved?
When I was in high school. You know, I played clarinet, too, when I was in, you know, very young. But I would get into trouble because I would complain about the repertoire. You know, we would be playing like Oklahoma or something, or Barry Manilow, and I was always piping up and saying, "This is crap. You know, we need some decent jazz charts in here."
My mother's Carla Bley.
And so the music teacher hated me, and I got, you know, the combination of quit and fired from the high school band, and so. The rest of my...
You were the Lisa Simpson kind of, right? How she, in the credits, she gets thrown out of the room for improvising.
Yeah. Well, so my mother gave me a harmonica, and for the rest of high school, I would sit on the stairs that led to the band room and play harmonica along with my Walkman cassettes, and sort of purposely, like I was in the way of the music teacher. He'd always have to walk around me, and this was my way of still sort of sticking it to him. But she just happened to give me one, and it was something portable, and I was listening to a lot of Stevie Wonder and saying, "Oh, I want to, what is that he's doing?" And so I would play along, and that's how I started. And then I was encouraged. My mother said, you know, it's such a plaintive sound, and it really matches like the way your voice is, which is really without frills and sort of vibrato-less, and it just seems like the most simplest sound. And that's what I wanted. Also, it's easier. I mean, clarinet, you know, you have to have this embouchure. And I tried flute, but it was really hard to be in tune. And bass hurt my fingers. And harmonica is almost like piano where, you know, you're just, it's in tune. It's, you know, hopefully.
And you play chromatic?
I played chromatic.
You chose that over diatonic?
Well, I had a diatonic one first, and I went to my mother and said, "There's something wrong with this. It doesn't have all the notes." And so then she got me a chromatic one. And not that it's easy. I mean, harmonica is sort of a strange instrument. You know, leaping, when you leap, I'm always like have my fingers crossed. Am I going to land on the right note? I hope so.
We all know this feeling. I mean, you can't... see what you're doing.
Yeah, but I guess if trombone players can do it, we can do it.
We can do it too. And I know you're a big Toots Thielman fan.
Yeah, well, of course. And I knew him. I mean, I would see him at festivals, and he was always very nice. I remember asking him, I said, you know, my harmonica got something stuck in it, and I need to know, like, how do you clean it? Because I took it apart, and I could never get it back together again. And he said, no, you have to send it to Hohner, because there's a little rubber thing buffering the slide, you know, and a little spring, and they have a tool for that, and you can't really do that, and it doesn't cost much. And so he was really nice and gave me his card and said, you know, to look him up when I was in Belgium. Of course, I never did, but...
So you didn't take any proper lessons on harmonica from
Well,
Toots?
I tried. No, not from Toots, but I did actually at one point take a harmonica lesson with a guy who was like a film score guy. I think his name was Robert Bonfiglio.
Bonfiglio, yeah, yeah.
And it was hilarious. He told me I was doing it completely wrong. And this was after I'd made a couple of records. And he tried to teach me his method, and I was just completely baffled and reduced to not being able to play at all. And then he gave me this speech about vibrato, and he said, well, you know, vibrato is very important. I mean, could you imagine a singer that sang with no vibrato, how horrible that would be? And I was thinking, that's how I sing. And so I never went back. Yeah.
Well, Miles Davis never played with a lot of vibrato trumpet.
He was just the wrong guy for me, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but it was interesting because I knew that I was doing it wrong, but then I just dug in and said, no, I can make this work, and I don't have to do it right. I mean, yeah, I'll never play super fast, but I don't want to play fast.
Do you read music on it?
Yeah.
And so the one thing that's nice about chromatic is every octave is the same. See, I play diatonic, and you have to get the right keys, and it can be a real, you know, mind scrambler.
Yeah.
Doing
and
all that transposition.
So what kind
stuff.
Of, are you, do you play like blues? Or
I play blues, mm-hmm. and I play, I've played in an opera. I played in Grapes of Wrath, so I had to read. But that was more like being a Glockenspiel player, because there were long periods of rest followed by a three-note, you know, figure. Mm-hmm. And so I had to learn to watch the conductor conduct in seven. I hadn't sat on the other side of a conductor since I was in middle school myself. Uh-huh. This was like 3 or 4 years ago. But it was a really awesome experience.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Wow. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think that chromatic, if you can, you know, learn it, it just frees you up, you know, and you don't have to be quickly getting the other harmonica or
it's
something.
It's a beautiful instrument, and the people who... I mean, to me, there's a group of people that sort of are the descendants of Toots. You know, nobody really plays like Stevie Wonder. And then you're kind of in your own universe with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have a specific philosophy with it?
Yes. I was thinking about it recently. Because also with my piano playing, I mean, I don't have much technique. But I do have a certain sense of time. And I have a sense of space. And I was thinking about harmonica, and like if I had a good night, like I played a gig and I was like, somehow the harmonica was just really working. And I think it comes down to breath. Sometimes the breathing just seems right, and it's just some sort of really organic thing where you feel good and you're putting your feeling into that, you know, and you can play one note, but if the breath is placed correctly and, you know, just how expressive it can be to blow gently and then blow more and then less. It's not even dynamics. It's, I don't know, maybe because I play organ and so I'm very aware of, like, the Leslie cabinet has a speaker that is spinning, and so I'm very aware of sound waves and how music is vibration. And I sometimes I get very moved by just the vibration of the note.
And unlike a lot of wind instruments, the thing that makes the note is really close to your body.
Yeah.
You know, there's a connection to it, I think, that other instruments don't quite have.
And there's a limit. I mean, the thing about like having to inhale and exhale to get the note, it limits you, you know. So that affects how you play. Like you can't just continue inhaling on a note indefinitely. And so I don't know, it helps me choose what to do. I mean, if you're playing an organ, you could just play a note forever.
Just hold your finger down. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's that sure-footedness I hear in your playing. I think there is like a certain understanding of harmony. Maybe that's just what I'm working on in my own musical stuff. And I'm like, yeah, you really seem to know or have that certain quality to it that I really like.
I'm very deliberate. I mean, I have to admit that I improvise, but I give it a lot of thought beforehand, and I study things, and I have an idea of how to approach that song. And I put in work into really thinking what the best path would be. And then, you know, change it as the mood moves me. But I tend to my mother instilled in me a certain sense of harmony, so I have, and it's not typical, you know, but it's very strong because I've been around it my whole life, you know, so.
And I want to talk about the subject matters of your songs. To me, there's this, I guess you could say Zen-like quality to it, because they're about, a lot of times, kind of common everyday things.
Homeless people in the park, get hungry after dark.
So your latest record is Business is Bad. How do you go about choosing which common everyday things, if you even see it that way, firstly? But
it's true. It's real life. I write about whatever happened today or yesterday.
And I love it, yeah.
You know, I mean, I usually write a song when I have a reason to. Like, I wrote a song called Con Edison. That's like the utility company in New York City. And it was because I hadn't paid my bills, and I got my electricity turned off. And so I sat there, you know, with candlelight and wrote a song called Con Edison, which was like a spiritual sort of casting Con Edison as God, like, please, Con Edison, I pray I'll be good and pay my bills from now on. If only you'll turn my electricity back on. And and it was true, you know, that's what had happened.
My magic pencil wrote this melody.
My magic pencil was because I was having a hard time writing a song, and Carla gave me this pencil, and she said, it's magic, it's gonna work. All you have to do is put it to the paper, I promise. It's got special lead. And so,
that's charming.
There was the song. I mean, I don't really consider myself much of a poet or anything. I mean, it is all just ordinary stuff. But, I mean, the music is my way of getting through things. Or it's really selfish. I mean, the song, I don't think, okay, what should I write for the people? I think of, you know, one of my, like, well, my cat just died. I think I'll write a song called Arnold's Dead, and then I can wallow in my misery.
Arnold
for a
got
while.
A lot of songs.
Arnold did, yeah. Yes. Arnold was special.
And so it seems to me, by your method, if we want to even call it that, like, there's subject matters for music and art and songs just kind of everywhere, and it's just choosing at that time to let it come, let it flow, like they say.
Yep.
But this song, Surviving You.
Like a dream interrupted suddenly, you are gone, and now I'm not sure, were you ever really here, and where did you go? Don't leave me behind, I thought we would never.
So I was on the train a couple weekends ago, listening to it. I was reading a book, and I was listening to your whole record, and then I noticed, and I have to not be reading right now. I have to put my full attention on the song Surviving You. It was so touching.
Wow.
Was it about anyone in any specific person?
Well, it's interesting because when I was writing it, Arturo O'Farrell's father, Chico O'Farrell, who was a very famous band leader, arranger, he died. And so I was thinking about that. I was thinking about his wife, Lupe, who had been left behind and was devastated. And at the same time, I had just been working with Robert Wyatt, and he has a very close relationship with his wife, Alfie, and they're getting older. And it was just making me think about sad, like when one person dies and the other one's left behind. I've been lucky. Not a lot of people close to me have died except Arnold. So I was just thinking about that. And then me and Carla were sort of laughing because we were saying, okay, now this is going to be a big hit. You're finally writing about something that everybody can relate to. Because, you know, I don't have any love songs or anything. And so I thought, oh, this is great. This is universal. And I remember telling Arturo, like, maybe I could get, like, Luther Vandross to record it. And he said, Karen, it's about death. I don't really think so. It's depressing.
Surviving You, getting Luther to sing? Yeah. I mean, well, ironically, he is not alive, so there's an issue there.
Well, and then also...
But I understand what you
mean. Elvis Costello. Yeah. I thought it would be a great tune for Elvis Costello.
For him. So many people.
I don't know why nobody will record it.
Elvis, if you're listening. I mean, you live in New York area. He must come through town every once in a while.
Well, yeah. Robert Wyatt knows him.
Okay.
But...
I'm sure you have many connections.
Yeah.
And you've worked with Robert Wyatt, formerly of Soft Machine, for how long?
Well, I know him through my parents. My father, Michael Mantler, has made a lot of records with Robert Wyatt starting in the 70s. And Carla also has worked with him as recently as with the Liberation Music Orchestra. There was in London, they have a thing called the Meltdown Festival. And I think there's a different curator every year. And that year it was Ornette Coleman. And so they had Liberation Music Orchestra. And Robert Wyatt was a big fan of Charlie Haden and agreed to sing one of their songs, which was amazing because Robert Wyatt's in a wheelchair and never performs live. So that was, I forget, that might have been 10 years ago. So he's an old family friend. And so we always sent him my CDs when I made one, and he would always encourage me. And then I don't know why he really liked the CD Farewell, which was a duo and really most disliked of all of my CDs. Nobody even knew it was out. And he wanted to make a record with me. And so this record that he made, Cuckoo Land, he actually included two of my compositions. And we did record Surviving You, but it didn't go on the record because he said he didn't want to record it before I had recorded it. He only wanted to do covers. So that was an incredible experience for me. I learned a lot from him. He's a lot where my harmonica style comes from. He also sings with no vibrato and very straight ahead. And he likes to whistle sometimes, which in a very plaintive way.
Which Toots also did.
Yes. Yeah.
And then, you know, you've done harmonica stuff. You were nice enough to bring some CDs that are of your mother's. Setting Calvin's Waltz. You're playing harmonica on that one?
Yeah, but these are very long pieces, so I don't know. She sometimes writes these suites, and back in those days with the big band, she had four main soloists, and so it would be like a story featuring these four people weaving in and out. And then sometimes I was sort of like the fifth soloist, and she'd write a little area for a small harmonica solo. So on Setting Calvin's Waltz, you know, I would say that there's a 3-minute harmonica solo on this 20-minute track, but beautiful, you know, like where the whole band will be playing, and then it comes way down to just piano, bass, and harmonica, and then builds slowly back up. And on another record, there's a piece called The Girl Who Cried Champagne, and that was very exciting, that band, because the rhythm section was Victor Lewis on drums and Don Elias on percussion, and we were playing all this Latin music, and I think I was like 20, and it was very difficult. Like, we were holding on for dear life, thinking, where's beat one? And so I play harmonica on one of these Latin tunes, but thankfully the slow section.
Looking around on YouTube for some of your music, and I ran across the episode of Night Music with David Sanborn from the late 80s.
Oh, yeah, that was
that
fun.
Show was so good. It had such an influence on me because I was in high school then, and they would have musicians on that really weren't getting a lot of radio airplay.
Yeah.
Maybe some, but not much. But people that are like part of my musical, you know, diet even now, like Todd Rundgren, Sun Ra. Was it the guy who messed with the records, Christian Marclay? All
yep.
these people. I'm this high school kid, you know. So yep. I learned, to me, what hip was, and all these hip New York musicians. And I think I saw the episode when it first ran that you and your mother were on, but I think you guys were on later because I watched. It's on YouTube now.
Yeah, I've seen it.
It's what's it like to go back in time?
Well, what was great, I mean, that show was the musical director was this guy Hal Willner. And he was the one responsible for bringing together all these eclectic people. He's the musical director of Saturday Night Live, has been for a long
yeah.
time. But he's made a lot of compilation records, like themes, like the music of Thelonious Monk, and then he'll get, each track will be a different artist, and they'll do a completely unique take on that. He's done a bunch of these. He's really wonderful and responsible for bringing together people. And so him and Dave Sanborn were really doing a justice to all of us. And like that episode, on that episode was Alan Toussaint, who to this day is one of my favorite writers
yeah.
of all time, Bootsy Collins, who, you know, always was a big fan of Funkadelic and George Clinton.
If I'm ever in a bad mood.
Yeah, that's my favorite party music.
Do you have a good Bootsy story? I was hoping you would.
Yes, it was hilarious. But it was great because we actually all played together. You know, like we each did our little segment. But at the end, we all played. Like Carla did an arrangement of one of her pieces, and Bootsy was on it. And along with his background singers, Pretty Fat, they were called. And Hiram Bullock was on the show, and Dave Sanborn was playing. It was great. And I was playing organ, and there's a whole section that's instrumental before Bootsy's going to start singing. And he came up on the stage and he sat down on my organ bench, and I was just beside myself that he was sitting next to me. And he was just hilarious because even when the camera wasn't rolling, like he had the bass shaped like a bright blue star. He was wearing sunglasses that were shaped like stars that had flashing lights. And this was just, you know,
just
in the lunchroom.
Out. Yeah.
And he was really, you know, he was sort of coming on to me. And I was like, I felt like when he sat next to me
How
on the
bench.
How old
were you at the time?
I was in my, I was 22 or something, in my prime.
Okay.
And I was just really shaking with like fear or something. It was
a
lot of
forward.
Fun. And he told a story on the show, you know, because Dave would interview the person. I don't know if that's on YouTube, but Dave was asking, asking him about, you know, playing with James Brown. And then he started talking about, yeah, and I think we were on acid a lot of the time. And Dave was getting very nervous about this was going on national TV and Bootsy's talking about acid.
In the Just Say No days of the 80s.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's great. Is he's alive, right?
Bootsy is, yeah.
What's he doing?
I saw him 2 or 3 years ago and he was fantastic. Just fantastic.
Yeah. Love him.
Just. Yeah. It was like I was grinning ear to ear the entire time.
Well, I recently did a thing with Hal Willner. He still puts on stuff, and we did, me and Carla had done in London a night of the music of Nina Rota, who wrote the music for the Fellini films. among other things, I did an arrangement of the music from The Godfather, featuring harmonica. And Carla...
Nino wrote or write that music? That's
he
right.
Did,
okay.
Yeah. And so recently in New York City, we did a show, again, like bringing together a bunch of esoteric people. This trumpet player Steve Bernstein wrote some great arrangements, and me. And
how do you even approach something? The Godfather is such a... Well, it's like Happy Birthday.
Well, no, but you know, there are a lot of, there's a lot of other parts to that song. Like, I forget, Il Padrone is another part that is less, it's not just da da vida do di do di do do. There is a whole other section that's in the background of a lot of scenes. Da do do di do di.
That's right, okay, yeah.
And so I sort of wove all those themes together, and that main famous theme is the least played of the whole thing.
Is there somewhere we can get a recording of that? Is that anywhere?
No, I don't really think that there's even a bootleg version online. No, no. But hopefully we'll do it again one day.
You know, it was kind of a break from one Karen Mattler solo record to the other. Are you planning on taking an equally long break? Or this one, yeah. Business is Bad, is about 2 years old now. But do you think we'll get one sooner? Because I would love to hear one.
Well, I hope so. I mean, that big break was because I was so disillusioned by having gotten signed by a major label and it being such a complete washout.
Yeah.
I made a great record. Nobody even knew it. And I got a little depressed and I said, what's the point? And the music business is very different now. And sometimes I just feel like there's so much music. I mean, it's really a selfish pursuit. If I made a record, you know, it's just I finally had enough songs and I wanted to do it. And I had musicians I wanted to play with. But this record hasn't sold anything either. And there's no demand. So it probably won't happen that soon. Well, thank you so much.
I really do.
That means a lot.
And so it seems to me that different artists have a different, there's so many different ways. It used to be, you know, make your record, you go on a label, distribution, you go on tour, you sell the record. That's not really the model anymore, but some artists, you know, are on a label, they're really huge, and then they put one out on the internet, and that becomes like this big news story. And like, you know, but then other people release a lot of stuff on the internet for free, or then other people, you know, it seems like with each artist, there's a different business model now, which has got to be pretty confusing as an artist, how to do that.
I think it's really in flux right now, and nobody's really figured this out. There is this issue of payment for, you know, content being distributed on the internet, but there are a lot of musicians working on that, and I guess it will come along. You know, it's just, it's a totally different world.
It is. Now. I'm kind of becoming a big fan of Bandcamp because, so Rob Fetters, this singer-songwriter guy in Cincinnati, he played with Adrian Belew in The Bears, and I stumbled on his latest record, which I totally loved. And so I was listening on Bandcamp, but you can only listen to it twice. And then it says, you got to pay. And so I paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob, you know, got his money.
Yeah,
and
I know
everyone
a lot of friends
happy.
Who use that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of thinking that seems to be a viable way to go for
it's interesting.
For the non-major label signees, you know,
which
is most musicians now.
Yeah.
But I know musicians who are professional who had, you know, they're kind of at that mid-level, and they're not even wanting to make records because they're kind of got that what's the point attitude about it.
I mean, for me, the point is that if you want to tour and play gigs other than the bar in Brooklyn, you need something that you're promoting. You need something that's going to generate some press and some interest. And that's the time to hit. You know, the record comes out, you get some reviews, and then there's something for a booking agent to sell.
Yeah.
You know, and then you can, because that's where you're going to making the money is performance. It's not going to be mechanical royalties. Like Carla is make, you know, she has a huge catalog, but the publishing money is less and less every year. And more she has to fill it in by playing live at 80. And she can't have a big band anymore. She has to have a trio because that's all anybody can afford, and that's how she can make a living.
And her last few records, or many of her records, are live records, so it's kind of like you don't have to go into a studio and do everything. And
that's the best way, particularly with the big band. You know, and the band is on the road. They've been playing it every night. and to go into the studio is so expensive, and also you get a different sound, you know. That worked out well for several of her records, just that you have that energy that's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I hope the follow-up to Business is Bad. Maybe it's it'll be Business is Good. No, I don't want to put any ideas. It's your thing, but it's a wonderful record, so everyone should give it a listen. And it's been great to – I've been a fan for so long, and it's just great to hang.
Thanks here. A lot. Yeah, it was very easy to talk to you.
And then you have to tell me, what song should we play out with? That's your pick.
Oh, let's see. I think it should be something I didn't write. You should play How Insensitive from the Robert Wyatt CD.
Is that Jobim?
It is Jobim.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful Karen Mantler on Harmonicast joining us. By the way, that's from the album Cuckoo Land by Robert Wyatt. It's great to meet her in person. Great to chat with her. Her website, by the way, it's wattextrawatt.com. It's WATTXTRAWATT. Wattextrawatt.com is the website for the record label Watt and Extra Watt, which has Carla Bley stuff and, of course, hers. I've also provided a link on my website, bobkesslerharmonica.com. That is where you can go to contribute to the Kickstarter campaign so I can get my ass to Nashville and interview Charlie McCoy, Buddy Green, and Jelly Roll Johnson in the coming weeks. So thank you very much for your generosity, everyone. Thanks for all the support, all the nice emails I get. This is Harmonicast. I'm Bob Kessler, and we'll see you next time.